Do you, Chris, take this woman to be your lawfully wedded wife? Do you promise to barrage her with obscure facts concerning comics, movies, TV shows, and toys?
I do.
And Cindy, do you take this man-child to be your lawfully wedded husband? Do you promise to humor him by engaging him in his obsessive ramblings, for better or worse, in pre-crisis or in post?
Sure, why not?
Then by the power invested in me by the High Father of the Fourth World, I now pronounce you Supermates. You may podcast with the bride.
Hello and welcome to episode 7 of Supermates, the Husband and Wife Geekcast. I'm Chris Franklin.
And I'm Cindy Franklin.
And we're going to skip the preamble this time because we have a lot of comic books to talk about.
Yes, yes.
So tonight we're going to talk about two of our favorite comic miniseries. Mine being The Untold Legend of the Batman from 1980.
And mine being the Wonder Woman miniseries by Trina Robbins.
The Legend of Wonder Woman from 1986.
Details, details, details.
You got to let them know what you're going to talk about. So these miniseries are kind of it's kind of interesting because they represent kind of where DC was at the beginning of the 80s and where they were at the middle of the 80s. At the beginning of the 80s, they were you had a lot of pretty much everybody working at DC was a fan turned pro. They had risen up through the comic fandom into professionals by this point. So you had a lot of younger creators kind of going back and going over the history of the characters and kind of retelling those stories in a more modern fashion without, you know, negating any of it. It was all still valid.
Well, they held the past comics in high regard, so they weren't just going to piss on it just like the, I'm sorry, most of the current comic writers do.
Yeah, there was definitely more of a reverence is the word I was getting ready to say. There was definitely more of a reverence, it seemed like, for the actual work. And, you know, you basically took it as it was. And if you needed to tweak things here and there to make it make sense or you kind of looked at it a little bit differently than you did. But if it was printed, it happened, kind of. For the most part, there were some things they said, no, that never happened. But The Untold Legend of the Batman definitely takes all the different stories that DC ran over the years that filled in the past of Batman and put them all in one narrative. But then when you get to the Legend of Wonder Woman, that occurs after the Crisis on Infinite Earths miniseries.
It's like an in-between kind of deal.
Yeah, it came out right a few months after Crisis on Infinite Earths ended. And of course, most people that listen to this realize, know what Crisis on Infinite Earth is, but in case you didn't know,
Lived under a rock.
Yeah, it is a 12-issue miniseries that DC ran from 1985 to 1986 that was meant to streamline their continuity and make it easier for new fans to understand. It's a great story, a great series. Ultimately, if that was the goal, the streamlining, I think they failed.
A little bit.
If you ask me, DC has been scrambling for an identity ever since. Some people felt that the multiple Earths aspect of DC continuity was too hard to understand.
I mean, I got it, and I was 10.
I got it when I was like 5. I mean, they put a panel in every story that told you, you know, Jay Garrick lives on Earth 2, Barry Allen lives on Earth 1. The end, you know. I mean, that's kids like that stuff. I think that was a case of the creators taking what a few fans said to heart too much, and they, you know, DC, you know, had been kind of underneath Marvel in sales for years. Marvel had overtaken them in the 70s. They were looking for something to, you know, to make them fresh, hipper. And I think that's a lot of what caused Crisis. It's a great series, but I think, personally, DC lost a lot of its unique identity because they did that. But neither here nor there, they did it. And so the Legend of Wonder Woman series was kind of like a... And even in the ads, I think they called it... we'll get to it later, but... It was like one last look at the original Wonder Woman.
Right.
So it was kind of a fond look back at Wonder Woman's heyday, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of had two different, you know, two different points where DC was. In just 6 years' time, the company had changed quite a bit, and the direction they were going in had changed. So, so we'll jump into, I guess we'll do The Untold Legend of the Batman first, since it came out first.
Okay.
Makes sense. So The Untold Legend of the Batman was written by Len Wein. It was penciled in issue number one by John Byrne and inked by Jim Aparo in that issue. And then from issue two and three, Jim Aparo handled pencils and inks. It ran from July through September of 1980. And DC had done something similar with Superman in Action Comics number 500 in 1979. Where they explored the history of the characters and cherry-picked the different flashback stories that appeared over the years and made them cohesive. They do that later with The Flash, like Flash number 300 was kind of like that. There was a World's Finest issue that put all the various Superman, Batman origins together. It was kind of weird. It was like the creators were really like dusting off the shelves in the house and putting things in order or something, you know,
yeah.
Right before they wrecked it with Crisis in a way. But now the writer, Len Wein, he was, you know, he's probably best known for co-creating Swamp Thing for DC in the early 70s. Then he left and went to Marvel and co-created some guy you probably never heard of called Wolverine.
Oh,
and,
yeah,
and some,
yeah.
Some,
yeah.
You know, added some really popular members to some team nobody ever heard of called the X-Men, you know the new X-Men. So he stayed at Marvel for a few years and then came back to DC, and he became the regular writer on Batman's title. And he was the regular Batman writer at the time this series was printed. John Byrne made a name for himself at Marvel. Also on X-Men, he had worked on Marvel Team-Up and Iron Fist before that and then made a big splash on X-Men. This was actually his first work for DC, and it's kind of an interesting story. He pencils issue number one, and then he's not on two and three, and that type of stuff happens quite a bit nowadays, but you just didn't hear that type of stuff much back then. I mean, there were fill-ins and stuff, but it was like a special project.
Right, right.
Usually it was just consistent. And according to the Byrne Robotics website, he had caught wind that DC was doing this. He was a big Batman fan. He wanted to draw Batman. He had a 3-month window where he could draw this series.
Mm-hmm.
And he contacted DC. They were interested in him. But they said, well, we can't pay you as much as Marvel pays you. And he said, oh, that's okay. I want to draw Batman. So he waits around a month. And into his second month that he's free, he finally gets the script for issue one. He draws it, and he doesn't hear anything else until his 3-month window is up.
Oh.
So he has to bow out, and well, he tells DC he's going to have to bow out, and they say, well, we'll pay you twice as much as Marvel would pay you. And he apparently, that kind of honked him off, which you can kind of understand.
Well, why can you pay me now and you couldn't pay me
yeah,
before?
Yeah, exactly. And so he didn't work for DC for quite a while. Until, you know, they came calling in 1986 after Crisis and said, hey, will you fix Superman? You know, and that's what most people assume, that's the first time he worked for DC, but no, he did this.
Right.
And he did some Who's Who work too, but as far as I think story stuff, this was pretty much it before Man of Steel. So, Jim Aparo, if you know your Batman, then you know about Jim Aparo. He had started drawing comics at Charlton. After working in advertising for years, he followed Dick Giordano over to DC when he came over as editor, and he worked on Aquaman and Phantom Stranger before starting work on the Brave and the Bold title, and he drew that book for over a decade and drew almost nearly every issue that had Batman, of course, the Batman team-up title back then. And then after that, he co-created Batman and the Outsiders, and then went back to the regular Batman title and Detective, and worked on Batman up until the 90s when he retired. So he is one of the seminal Batman artists of all time, and definitely a fan favorite amongst Bronze Age fans. So his Batman is Batman. So you can't go wrong there. One weird thing about this series on a personal level is, you know, I was 5 when this came out, but I saw the ads in the comics. And, you know, even, you know, I couldn't read, but I'm sure my mom read them to me or whatever. And, you know, you could tell that this was another Batman series.
Right.
And I remember the ads had Thomas Wayne in the Batman costume and things like that. It was really interesting looking. I never could find the books. And they just kind of came and went, and I never saw them. And then in 1982, I was at the drugstore where I usually bought my comic books. I look over on the little paperback novel spinner rack, and there is this paperback novel that's called The Untold Legend of the Batman. And it is the comic book chopped up. The panels are chopped up, and it's printed in black and white, but it's pretty much the entire series,
mm-hmm.
minus a few panels for editing, in paperback form. And I bought it, and I read that thing to death. And then a few years after that, well, it was 1989 when the movie came out, I got another copy of it, found that it was, you know, with Batman being so popular, anything Batman that was still in print was everywhere. And also that year, a company called MPI put out an audio book and cassette version of it, kind of like the Power Records, like the Power Records that me and Rob Kelly talked about on the Power Records show, but not as good. I haven't listened to them in a long time, but I remember being disappointed in them. But that way, I got the comics finally. They're smaller than a regular comic. They're not full size, which is kind of weird. But they're still, I think they pretty much print them exactly as was.
Right, right.
So it's kind of had a, it's kind of a, been in some strange formats. Oddly enough, I don't think DC has ever collected this in a trade paperback.
Wonder why.
I don't know. Maybe because it's so short. It's only 3 issues.
Well, and it seems like the issues are shorter in and of themselves.
Yeah, that's back when page counts were pretty low. And so that might be part of it too. So, and, you know, for whatever reason, they weren't big-sized issues either. So, they'd almost have to put it in with something else. It's 6 issues is kind of a standard for a trade paperback, a regular-sized trade paperback. So now we'll give you a little synopsis of issue number 1 and go in that direction. So, issue number 1 was called In the Beginning, and the cover was by Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise be his name. And he did pencils and inks on that one. And the cover for this one's really neat because it shows the Joker, the Penguin, and the Riddler. The Joker's getting ready to open this giant book that says The Untold Legend of the Batman. And, you know, he says, this book will tell us everything we need to know to defeat Batman. The Batman, sorry, the Batman. It was the 70s. You had to call him the Batman. Or the 70s, 80s. There's a really cool symbolic cover. You just don't see those type of covers anymore. So, you know, why is there a book that big, or why are they that small? I don't know. But it's Gotham, giant props. You know.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, but anyway. So our story begins in the man-made Batcave beneath the Wayne Foundation building. Batman is opening his mail and has one package left as Alfred approaches. The Dark Knight is stunned to find the box contains the shredded remains of a costume. The costume worn by the first Batman, his father. Batman races over to the trophy case where the costume is supposed to preside. Instead, he finds a mysterious note reading, "This is only the beginning, Batman. Before I'm done, I will destroy you." Batman then reminisces about his origins, beginning with the first night he saw his father in that costume. Unable to discern any clues by examining the shredded suit, he hits the streets.
I'm sorry, it's just the whole series, and I'm going to say this, and you're going to beat me, but it's just coincidence. Oh, the da-da-da-da-da. And I mean, that's just, you know, I mean, it's a good story, but in and of, but it's coincidence. It's just like, oh, how convenient that just worked out.
But comics, especially superheroes comics, are just based on coincidence, if you think about it. You know, Peter Parker just happens to get bitten by a radioactive spider. Barry Allen just happens to get struck by a lightning bolt and chemicals. You know, I mean, that's the foundation of comic book superheroes. So you can't, you know.
Well, I mean, meh. But anyway, I just, this whole thing about, you know, who killed his parents and why his parents were killed, they took that out of the Batman legend, you know, in this story. And that bothered me.
You mean the random street crime?
Yeah,
aspect?
I mean,
well, yeah, I mean, that's, and we'll go through the actual backstory in this series as we go through the notes. So basically, what you get is Batman's parents are murdered by Joe Chill, but that is the original, or murdered by a street thug. That's the original origin that was told, the first time it was ever told in Batman number 33, Detective number 33, I'm sorry. But over the years, they, you know, would go back and they'd add this and add that. And so that's kind of what this book does, is it kind of takes all that stuff that maybe some people had forgotten and lays it all out for you. You know, this. And that's why it's the untold legend of the Batman.
I know.
And it's really the retold legend of the Batman.
Right.
But for most fans, and, you know, I mean, and back then, you know, they went through a period in the 80s where almost every issue they showed his parents getting killed.
Right.
Because Frank Miller had done it in The Dark Knight, and then him and Mazzucchelli had done it in Batman Year One, and everybody wanted to do their version of his parents getting killed.
Right.
So every time, you know, he closed his eyes, he saw his parents die, and, you know, that stuff. But Batman was a lot, despite this story, which we'll get into, Batman was a much more well-balanced and less psychotic person back then, less in need of therapy than the any taken in the past 25 years. Going through, you know, you start out in the Batcave, but it's not the traditional Batcave that most people know. In the 70s, Bruce and Alfred had left Wayne Manor right as the 70s started and had moved to the Wayne Enterprises building, back then it was Wayne Foundation building, in downtown Gotham. And for years there was basically no Batcave. If Batman needed a Batcave, he went back to the old one, used the equipment. But when Steve Englehart came in the mid-70s, they had moved everything to this new man-made Batcave. So that's where the story takes place. Alfred asked Batman if he is well, because he had recently been involved in a warehouse explosion while tussling with Catwoman. That's from Batman number 324, June 1980, which was a month before this. This gets brought up a lot. It's kind of Chekhov's gun. It's going to go off by the end of the story, and you can kind of tell. So that's, you know, it just keeps coming up. But they kind of have to, really. But, yeah, if you read it all together, you're like, okay, this is definitely something's going on here.
Here is the neon sign pointing. Look at this. Look at this. Remember this.
Yes.
It's like a teacher that's going to give you a pop quiz, but tells you there's going to be a pop quiz and tells you what the questions are.
Yeah. So Batman first remembers back to when his father had dressed in the bat costume that he gets in the mail and it's shredded. And Thomas and Martha Wayne, his parents, go to a costume ball. That's based on flying creatures, and it's kind of funny because in one panel, John Byrne sneaks in a character who looks a lot like his design of the Angel from the X-Men. Yeah, he's got a bird mask, but the bodysuit and the wings are exactly the same. So Thomas Wayne gets abducted from the party by a crook named Lou Moxon, who's a bank robber who's been injured. He figured there was a doctor there amongst all these rich people. He was right. He wants Wayne to heal him. Fix him up. Wayne's not going to do it. Turns on him, fights him. Somehow he's, you know, able to hold his own against a bunch of hardened criminals, even though he's a doctor and a rich guy. But hey, you know. Moxon goes to court. Wayne testifies against him, and he vows that he's going to get, you know, even with him someday. And then Batman's flashbacks jump forward to the night his parents are murdered. By Joe Chill, and of course everybody knows, you know, they're walking in the alleyway of Park Row, which later becomes Crime Alley. In this version, both Thomas and Martha are shot. DC had at one point sanitized the origin in the 40s where Thomas was shot and Martha died of a heart attack.
Right.
Because they just, I guess they thought it was just too rough to...
Violence against women.
Yeah, it was just too rough to, you know, shoot a woman, especially on panel. Now, here you have probably the first time this was actually added into the other tellings of the origin. You get Leslie Tompkins, who had been introduced in about Denny O'Neill in There's No Hope for Crime Alley, that famous issue of Detective Comics in the 70s. And she comforts Bruce the night that his parents are murdered. Now, in later post-crisis revisions, she is given more of an important part in Bruce's life, even becoming a co-caregiver with Alfred. And in the animated series, she's established as a confidant and a comrade of Thomas Wayne, a peer, a colleague. There you go, a colleague.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. Colleague of Thomas.
A fellow doctor.
Fellow doctor and friend of Thomas Wayne. But here, you know, she's just a woman.
And that, I like that treatment.
I do too. She was handled really well on there in the few times she was on there. So in this version, Bruce is sent to his Uncle Philip, who must be Thomas's brother. Uncle Philip travels a lot, so he's left in the care of Mrs. Chilton. And while Batman's talking about this, Alfred has a little thought balloon that says, you know, Master Bruce must never know that Mrs. Chilton is the mother of his parents' murderer, Joe Chill. So Alfred apparently knows this, Bruce does not. And,
sorry, but this points to bad detective skills on Batman's part. Hello?
Well, he wasn't looking for that. I don't know. I don't have the comic. Apparently that was from, from Batman number 208, January, February, 1969. That was a giant special that was mostly reprints. The important women in Batman's life, and they introduced the idea of Mrs. Chilton as the caregiver for young Bruce. Then we move to Bruce, you know, he's studying to be Batman, or he vows on his parents' grave, of course. We got to get to that part. Very dramatic scene. Very well handled by Byrne and Aparo. And then you get, Bruce needs to hone up on his detective skills. He hears about this famous detective named Harvey Harris. He doesn't want his identity known, so he comes up with a fanciful and very familiar-looking costume, with a red vest, yellow cape, green trunks.
Ugh, I'm sorry. That's the biggest one. Hard for me to swallow.
So he shows up, helps Harris, and saves Harris' life. And Harris agrees to train him as a detective and tells him because he's got the red vest, he'll call him Robin because he's got a red breast like a robin. So Bruce becomes the first Robin.
Ugh, I'm sorry, but that is groan-inducing. I know that they're trying to yam stuff in and make it all fit, but it's still groan-inducing.
Well, it's kind of interesting, and I didn't know this for sure until, because this was my introduction to this aspect, and even as a kid, I'm like, really, Bruce was the first Robin? But that tale actually was from Detective 226, from December 1955. It actually predates the first Batman story where Thomas Wayne was the first Batman. That was from Detective 235 from 1956. So like a year earlier, they introduced the idea of Bruce being Robin before Thomas Wayne being Batman first. So, you know. Hey. So,
you could see me right now, I'm rolling my eyes. Can't help it. And it talks about, you know, the next page of the comic is him spending all this time with Detective Harris. And, you know, he's doing this and he's doing that and blah, 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 blah. Well, here's the problem I have with that. Miss Chilton, Joe Chill's mother, is supposed to be looking out for him. Because, you know, Philip's off gallivanting around, you know, way to take your responsibilities, you know,
your
to heart.
Let you with, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so he's left with the housekeeper, but I kind of can see why Joe Chill turned out to be a criminal, because if Bruce Wayne is out all day gallivanting and doing this with some man that she probably's never laid eyes on, there's a problem with that, you know.
In that
lack
outfit.
Of supervision. Exactly.
He's with a strange man in that outfit.
No, a bad. I wasn't even going there. I'm just talking about, you know, as a mother,
there.
I would know where my child is for, you know, 8, 9, 10 hours of the day. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
And he's a Richie Rich. So, and then he lives 14 miles outside the city. So is he like, how's he getting there? I mean, come on.
So Bruce, Batman's still thinking back, he thinks about how he continued to study, train, went to college, found out basically that the law, the actual legal system, and his idea of justice did not always match up. So he felt like he couldn't be a policeman. So you have the famous scene where he's in his father's study, and the bat flies through the open window. Back then it was open, guys, before Frank Miller went all, you know, cinematic dramatic on us. And crashed through the glass.
Right.
This time it went through the open window. And this scene's pretty much lifted almost verbatim from the first Batman origin. So, you know, it's an omen. I shall become a bat. He becomes Batman, of course. You know, you have a really nice splash page Byrne and Aparo did of Batman and Robin knocking the Joker out with all, like, nice little headshots of the other villains in the background. Really cool. Then you get, you know, when they're talking about how Batman finally caught his parents' murderers, caught up with Joe Chill, and that's from Batman number 47, The Origin of Batman from 1948. I always really liked this part of the story. You know, Batman confronts Joe Chill and actually reveals that he's Bruce Wayne.
Right, right.
Pulls his mask off. He's tried to pin stuff on him. He can't. He's desperate. He's got to nail him. Chill runs out and tells his thugs that, you know, Batman's after me. And he says the reason he became Batman's because I killed his parents. And his own men turn on him because, yeah, you know, Batman had busted them before. And just in a rage, they shoot him and kill him before they even have a chance to ask who Batman is.
And then they're like, after he's laying there dying, he's like, they're like, oh, well, we shouldn't have done that before he told us.
Yeah, right.
Not that they wouldn't have done it, just that they should have waited to do it.
Right, right. So, always really like that aspect. And then, you know, of course, that story came before the first Batman story. So, the Wayne murder was closed and then reopened when Bruce and Dick find Thomas Wayne's old Batman costume and some film footage from the party. Where Thomas is in the bat costume, and they go looking for Lou Moxon. It turns out Lou Moxon doesn't remember anything about Thomas Wayne. He had been in a car accident and had lost several years of memory. So Batman's trying to find some way to nail this guy. He's fighting a bunch of thugs. He gets his costume shredded, and Dick says, hey, why don't you wear your dad's old Batman costume? So he shows up in Thomas Wayne's costume, confronts Moxon, who suddenly remembers everything on seeing a guy who thinks he's supposed to be dead, and in fear runs out in front of a truck and is killed.
Okay, I have a problem with this.
Okay.
The whole point of Batman is he doesn't kill all of these criminals because he, you know, in the hopes of rehabilitation.
Right.
What was Lou Moxon doing that was criminal? He had a, what was it? A sky-high advertising business is what it is. Mm. And so was he leading a lawful life? That's what I want to know. Because if he was, then wasn't he rehabilitated?
No, I think I haven't reread the original story. It doesn't get into his criminal activities in this, but I'm pretty sure he's into criminal stuff too.
But it doesn't say
it
that
doesn't
he was.
Say that. Yeah.
And to me, if he was leading a law-abiding life, then what Batman did was wrong. He was so wrapped up in, I must nail him, I don't care. He has been, you know, even
yeah, but he ordered a hit on Thomas Wayne and had him killed.
But the whole point is, you know, Bruce Wayne is always like, oh, I have to rehabilitate him. I want him to be better. I want, you know, I don't want to kill him. I want to send him to jail and make him come out. Well, if he isn't leading criminal activities, which is not pointed to in this version,
right,
then he is, you know, it goes completely against what he's supposed to be doing.
I don't know, though. When you hire somebody to kill somebody else, I mean, I don't care how many years it's been, and I don't care if you, you know, you give to the poor and work in a soup kitchen the rest of your life, you still had somebody killed. So Batman's got to go after him, you know. So I don't have any problem with that. But so the story ends, you know, Batman.
Don't ask for my opinion if you don't want
it. No, I want your opinion. I'm just telling you I disagree with it. So the story ends. Batman, you know, can't find anything from the costume. He hops in the Batmobile and takes off into the night. And before we pull out of this episode, there's a really good episode of before we pull out this issue, I'm sorry. There's a really good episode of Batman: The Brave and the Bold animated series where they take elements of the first Batman and the Joe Chill, the origin of Batman, where he catches up to Joe Chill, and they mix them together. It's called Chill of the Night. It's a really good episode of Brave and the Bold that really feels like a Batman the Animated Series episode written by Paul Dini. So, really great stuff.
Hammer Film Productions began in 1934, and after producing almost 200 films and television programs, the studio is still releasing and re-releasing new and classic film titles. 1951 Down Place is the podcast that brings you the story of the great Hammer films, one movie at a time. Here are your hosts, describing what Hammer means to them. First is Casey.
Hammer means the beautiful and glamorous women of Hammer horror, the engaging storytelling, and amazing period films.
Joining him is Derek.
Hammer means the incredible work of actors like Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee, and even Michael Ripper. The gothic storytelling, the incredible music, and the set pieces.
And finally, here's Scott.
Hammer, wasn't that an 80s cop show on ABC with David Raich?
This boy has a lot to learn. Join our hosts as they make their journey through the Hammer Films catalogue and discuss each film with critical opinion, historical facts, production notes, and other information about these classic films. 1951 Down Place can be found in iTunes or their website, www.1951downplace.com.
Wait, that was Sledgehammer.
1951 Down Place, the home of Hammer Films discussion.
Okay, so now on to issue number two. Issue number two is called With Friends Like These, and the cover's by Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise be his name, and Dick Giordano. And yes, I have to do that every time. Seeking answers, Batman visits a local dive and loses control, trying to extract information from the riffraff inside, until Robin steps in and calms him down. The two leave in the Batmobile as Batman relates his story. Robin reminisces about his origins as they head back to the Batcave. There, Alfred tells the Teen Wonder about Batman's recent head injury and how he was worried for his master. Then it's Alfred's turn to do the way back thing, as he recalls his life before Wayne Manor and how he discovered the dynamic duo's secret identities. Talking over possible suspects causes Batman to relate the origins of the Joker and Two-Face. Robin decides to hit the streets once more, but notices a strange beeping coming from the Batmobile ignition. The car explodes, nearly killing our three heroes. An enraged Batman finds another note from his elusive tormentor. I love Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise be his name's work, but this cover has always bothered me. Robin looks pissed. I mean, he looks like he's just madder than hell driving out of there, and Batman's like trying to leap into the car, and he's like yelling at him, but the word balloon's like, "Someone has learned all the secrets of my past, Robin, and is using them to destroy me." So, I mean, it's like, okay, what? It almost looks like Robin's got mad. He's taken the Batmobile. When I first saw this cover, I'm like, okay, it's like, that a Robin robot? Is Batman bad? Is Robin bad? What's, you know, what's going on? It just doesn't seem to really make a lot of sense. It looks great, but it just never seemed to make a whole lot of sense. At the beginning, Batman's in this dive, and he's questioning this guy, and he ends up going off on him because he pulls a gun. The guy's named Snitch.
Yeah.
The poor guy, I mean, he had no chance in hell of ever getting a different job.
I think it's his nickname, Dave.
Oh, okay. Okay. Robin relates his origin. It's barely changed from Detective Number 38. You just get a few... Just a few scenes of how Dick Grayson dealt with, you know, growing up as Bruce Wayne's ward and not being able to reveal that he could, you know, kick all the kids in school's butt if he, you know, when he needed to.
Now, see, I like in this issue, it talks about, you know, he goes, he's taken by Bruce and he's taken to the Batcave that very night.
Uh-huh.
And makes the vow and everything.
Uh-huh.
Now, on the animated series,
which
it was
we covered.
I know, but yeah. I mean, it was several weeks or months or what, you know, however long. Right. There was a time period frame before he knew that Bruce was Batman and before he made the vow and all that stuff.
Right.
Making this vow the very first night that he sees him, that's interesting.
Well, you know, you got to figure, too, the first version of this was like an 8-page story. So you had to get in and out quick, you know.
Yeah, I
do like the way the animated series handled it for sure. That was Robin's Reckoning. We covered that in episode 3.
Something
Super
like
Mates?
That. Yeah.
I think so. So, yeah, that's, you know, of course, one of our favorite episodes. One thing I always loved about this, Robin asked Alfred for Dr. Pepper. When I was a kid, just a few years ago when I quit drinking a whole lot of pop, I was a big Dr. Pepper man. And so I always thought, I was like, Robin likes the same pop I do. You know, so it's great. Again, Alfred tells Robin of the warehouse explosion. We even get the same nice little, you know, panel of Batman, you know, as
explosion there.
The explosion going off as he kind of leaps away.
Don't forget this, folks. It's very important for the story arc.
Yeah. So Alfred gets to have his flashback. And I'm not sure... unfortunately, where this came in, this might have been the first time it was mentioned, Alfred's military background is mentioned here. And this would become more important as the years gone by.
Right, right.
The animated series even, you know, had like a, you know, Alfred was involved in some secret agent type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They played that up in the recent Batman Year One, Batman Earth One, sorry, Earth One graphic novel. They put it into... the Beware the Batman based on that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, in the Nolan movies, you get the idea Michael Caine was involved in some government military work as well. So that becomes a pretty important part of Alfred's backstory. And, of course, the acting as well. What's really interesting here to modern readers would be kind of taken aback that Alfred wasn't there at first in the Batman books.
No.
And so he, you know, Alfred appeared in the comic books. I think it was Batman number 16. I didn't write that down, but that's just off the top of my head. Could be wrong.
Wrong about Batman? I don't think so.
I could be. But I think that's right. And when he showed up, he was kind of a heavyset guy. But they don't do that here. But they do have that, you know, Alfred, Alfred's father, Jarvis, had worked for Thomas Wayne. And he, you know, on his deathbed, he asks Alfred if he'll, you know, go and take care of the Waynes, which is kind of, you know, you're a successful actor, my boy, but I want you to go be a butler, you know.
I'm like.
It's like, yeah, sure, Dad. And after he dies, it's like, sorry, old man, no way.
But, I mean, he does, and he makes a
vow. He's a gentleman's gentleman. He vowed to his dad, so he goes and does it. So he goes. And Bruce and Dick are like, we don't really need a butler. You know, it's like, oh, crap. You know, how long
is it? But what I think's hilarious is, you know, here's these two, you know, they're already crime fighters, you know, because Robin's already there. He's already established. And he's like, no, I'm here. And they don't pitch him out or anything else. They're just like,
Yeah. So they put up with him. And, but I did really like the, you know, Alfred, you know, he gets into his duties and stuff. And then one night he hears, you know, Dick yelling, Alfred, Alfred. And, he's waking up in the night and he says, well, is the place haunted? You know, Master Bruce and Master Dick are out for the evening. What's going on? And he hears the wailing coming from behind the grandfather clock. And he opens it up and there's Batman. He's been shot and Robin's pulling him up the stairs, you know. And it was really a cool way to, you know, how Alfred learned their secret identities. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a really, really neat way to do it. And of course, I like Alfred, you know, raising Bruce and everything. You can't beat that. But it is kind of a neat story that's totally been just, it's gone. When Miller.
That part of the origin's gone.
When Miller did that in Batman Year One and The Dark Knight, I mean, it's, you know, that it's gone. That part's gone. So back in the present, they're looking over the Rogues Gallery. Yep. And to see who could be behind this. And of course they point out the Joker. It's got to be the Joker. He's the number one bad guy. And this is where I first learned about the Red Hood. You see, Joker is the Red Hood. That's from Detective number 168, February 1951, The Man Behind the Red Hood. And
now I like about this, you know, in a lot of the other versions, it's, you know, the Red Hood and Batman were grappling, and the Red Hood, you know, falls into the chemicals.
Right.
In this version, he purposely dives into it.
Yeah.
And I like that because, you know, he's more responsible for his own creation.
Yeah, it's not like in, like, well, even though he wasn't in the Red Hood, like in the Batman movie in 89 when him and Batman are,
right.
And he shoots him in with the thing, the bullet bounces off his gauntlet, hits him in the cheek, and he falls.
Right.
And Batman's got a hold of him, and it's all the Joker. You're right.
I like this.
He leaps in on his own to get away from Batman and Robin, and Batman and Robin are there. That's always forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
Robin's never there. Robin is never there when he meets any of his key foes in flashbacks. It's like he was around before any of the main rogues first appeared, if you don't count Hugo Strange. It just irks me. But, of course, he swims through the chemicals, comes out with his hair green. You know, we all know the story. And then they go through Two-Face's origin, pretty standard. We all know that.
And I also like, in this part, I mean, he talks about his fragile ego.
Yeah.
Where Bruce Timm changed that, and he was already being treated for split personality.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah,
that added it, and that made Two-Face's origin for me.
Yeah, that was... that was, I think, Alan Burnett, the producer, of another producer of the series, was a writer on that one,
mm-hmm.
The Two-Face episodes. And, yeah, that was great. Big Bad Harv.
Yeah.
I think there was a comic origin of Two-Face that had touched on that right before the animated series came out, but I think it was just one of those coincidence things.
Right.
I don't think that they knew about that version. If I remember, my dates might be off, but... That was definitely, you know, it definitely made so much more sense that he already had a fragmented personality and the disfiguring just brought it out. But, you go over Two-Face's origin and they're not finding out anything. So Robin decides he's going to jump in the Batmobile and check out some more clues. He turns the key and starts hearing a beeping. The Batmobile explodes and... it's a pretty cool, dramatic ending. You know, Batman finds a note at the end. Pretty sweet. This version of the Batmobile, it was designed by Dick Giordano in 1978, and it was put into use right away on the Super Friends TV show during the challenge of the Super Friends and was seen on the show from then on and lasted in the comic books into the 90s. You'd see it occasionally. And it was the basis of the superpowers. Toy, which, you know, we talked about last time.
Right.
So that was always one of my favorite Batmobiles. So that'll wrap up issue 2. So now on to issue number 3, The Man Behind the Mask. Covered by Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise be his name, and Dick Giordano. Batman is ticked. He tells Robin to take care of matters in the Batcave while he continues to hunt for the man out to destroy him. Robin knows better than to fight with him, so he makes a call to Hollywood stunt driver and car customizer Jack Edison, and orders a new Batmobile. Batman questions his usual informants, but they don't give him any leads. Desperate, he seeks counsel with Commissioner James Gordon. Gordon deduces Batman hasn't found his man yet because it is someone too close to him, and Batman doesn't want to find him. Batman leaves mysteriously, of course, leaving Gordon with his thoughts on how the two met and how his daughter Barbara eventually became the Domino Daredevil Batgirl. The next day, a weary Bruce Wayne checks in at the Wayne Foundation, but not even a concerned Lucius Fox can stir Wayne out of his depression. Gordon's deduction the night before leads Batman to the abandoned Wayne Manor, where he is startled by echoes of the past. Himself as a young boy with his father is the first Batman, and Dick and Alfred appear to him. He descends through the secret entrance into the Batcave, only to have its walls slowly begin to move in on him as another ghost appears. Bruce Wayne. Wayne admits it was he who was out to destroy Batman, so he could finally live. Morally beaten by himself, Batman is about to give in when he is surprised by the living embodiment of his father in his original Batman costume. The elder Wayne pleads with his son to not succumb to his temporary madness, as it is only the result of the explosion he was caught in recently.
Aha!
Aha! The cave walls continue to close in, and Bruce makes a last desperate dive, pushing himself and his father out of the cave door in the nick of time. Batman instantly knows his father is really Robin in disguise, but the whole thing worked to shock Batman back out of his paranoid delusion and back to his senses. A triumphant Batman leaves to sort out his thoughts and feelings while overlooking the city he has vowed to protect. This one has a great poster-like cover by Jose Luis Garcia Lopez. Praise be his name. It's very similar to the artwork he'd do later for the DC Style Guides. And it was also the cover of the tour, little tour paperback. Not sure where Jack Edison, the mechanic car designer, come from. This is possibly his first appearance. I have never seen him mentioned again, although on the animated series they had a different mechanic character who...
Well, he's probably like Thomas Edison's great-great-grandson or something, you know, yeah, with the name of Edison. You know, I'm sure that's, you know...
It might be. Now, you brought up a good point when we were talking about this earlier about the Batmobile.
I know. If you read the comic, it says in there, okay, man, I got to get back to the set now, but, it'll be on the Gotham docks in a week. Now, think about this. Not only is he going to construct from the ground up, because he says he just has the plans on paper, a ground up, tricked out Batmobile car, plus shipping time. Hello? It takes a little longer than a week. And he's working during this whole time on this stunt movie. You know, doing the stunts on this movie. I mean, what?
Yeah, that's maybe the... Even though there's people dressed as bats and you know, guys that turn into, you know, homicidal clowns, and that might be the most unbelievable thing in this whole series.
What? No.
When Batman visits Gordon, and then Gordon goes into his flashbacks, I think probably most of those were new to this series. I don't really know if they had explored, you know, how Batman and Gordon finally buried the hatchet and became, you know, I mean, they kind of did in the 40s, but it was a different take, you know. It was like they were duly deputized. Come on, Adam West, get in my head. Duly deputized.
Yes, agents of the law.
Exactly. I think this was kind of a more unique telling. Now, this bit about Barbara, for the most part, was pulled straight from Detective Number 359, January 1967.
But he knows that she's Batgirl.
Yeah, at this point he knows. He knows she's Batgirl, yeah. Lucius Fox, he was a pretty recent creation of writer Len Wein. And he had first appeared in Batman number 307 in January 1979. So he was a new cast member. And, of course, went on to probably his biggest prominence in the Nolan movies, because he was played by God, Morgan Freeman, you know.
Yeah, you know. You give a role to Morgan Freeman, you know.
Right.
If Morgan Freeman's in your movie, you know you've got a good movie.
Right, right. Well, at least his part's good anyway.
Exactly. True.
You know, the ending was actually, you know, fairly satisfying, but... another thing, maybe even weirder than Jack Edison's bit, how did Batman engineer the solid rock walls of the Batcave to close in? And how long did that take? And how crazy was he anyway? I mean, did he...
Well, I mean, that was just all in his mind. He was having a feeling of
no,
the walls
no,
closing
that
in.
Was really happening, because it almost crushed him and Robin. No, I think that really happens.
The way I read it, it was in his mind. He was trying, you know, it was all...
No, I think because if you read it, Dick's like, you know, go on, save yourself, you know. I think it really is closing in on him. And that's the way I always interpreted it.
I didn't get that
read. You thought it was in his head?
Yeah.
Well, maybe, but... Here, let me flip. We're going to have to take a break or flip through there. So let's do. So, you know, you've got... Dick says, you know, of course, he's still acting like Thomas Wayne. Go on, son, get out of here. I can hold the walls open until you're safe. Did you hear me, son? Run. The world is waiting for the Batman. And, you know, Batman's like, no, I can't. I can't let you die. Not again. Not again. And he jumps and tackles Thomas / Dick. And they come, the next panel, they're coming out of the Batcave entrance, and the walls are closing, and it says, whoomp. So, to me, it was physically moving in on him. I mean, I could say see it your way, too, but I've always assumed that it really was closing in on him. But overall, you know, this series, to me, it's hard for me to be critical of it, because it was kind of like my Bible of Batman.
Right, you know? Right, and I understand
it's like a little Gideon's Bible in the tour, you know, version. Found it in hotel rooms, you know, open the door, oh, it's the Untold Legend of the Batman. Oh,
oh wow. You're going to have to go to church and put extra money in there in the morning.
So, you know, I thought it, you know, it was, I thought it was really, you know, it was well told.
I understand, you know, them wanting to put this piece in there and that piece in there and making sure it fit and stuff like that. But again, it's just like, oh, coincidence. You know, oh, how handy was that it just, you know, worked out that
well,
way.
In a way, in some ways, this series and other, like Action 500, like The Flash 300, they, in a way, were cataloging the baggage that had cropped up over the years. And in some cases, you know, despite how enjoyable this is, you know, some creator or editor at DC could say, look at this. Bruce was Robin. His dad was Batman. We need to clean this stuff out, you know.
Right, yeah,
we need to get back to the original origin, you know. The bad part is that's all well and good, but it's no sooner did they say, okay, we're resetting everything. This, you know, this didn't happen. Of course, Batman wasn't as quite as... His revamp wasn't as complete as Wonder Woman's and
Superman's.
Right,
all-encompassing.
Yeah, it kind of just, you know, they filled the backstory in differently, basically. But at the same time, as soon as they hit that reset button, it starts accumulating again.
Right,
because everybody wants to go back in and monkey with the old stuff.
Everybody wants to put their little touch on it, so, you know.
Right.
So if somebody else comes back and say, oh, well, that came from this guy, and that came from that guy, you can say, oh, well, that's the part I put in, you know.
Well, one thing you can say, and I don't have this in front of me, but a good chunk of these, a lot of the stories from this one were written by Bill Finger, so... You know, if he wants to add stuff, tack on. He wrote the first version, so if he wants to add to it, who had more right to do so? So, but
I do like they do mention that where he comes down Finger Alley when he's driving the Batmobile.
Yeah, yeah, the cul-de-sac that the Batmobile entered in to get to the Wayne Foundation building was called Finger Alley. Yeah, that was really cool, and that was a permanent part of the Bronze Age books back then.
Do you enjoy time travel in general and the Silver Age of comic books in particular? If so, join me each week on the Superman Fan Podcast. My name is Billy Hogan, and I will be your host. Together, we'll crash through the time barrier and fly into the past to explore the Silver Age adventures of Superman. One week, we will take a look at the Superman family of titles, Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen, World's Finest Comics, and soon, Superman's girlfriend Lois Lane. The next week, we will feature the Man of Steel's titles, Superman and Action Comics, which will include the Supergirl stories during her run in the back of that title. You can join me each week on Wednesday or Thursday at the SupermanFanPodcast.blogspot.com, which is available on iTunes. And your emails are always welcome at SupermanFanPodcast@gmail.com. And don't forget to wear your red indestructible cape.
So that'll do it for the Untold Legend of Batman.
Mm-hmm.
The Untold Legend of the Batman. So now we're going to jump into The Legend of Wonder Woman.
Mm-hmm.
And that was by writer, co-plotter, Kurt Busiek, artist, co-plotter, Trina Robbins, and was edited by Alan Gold. Oh, and Paul Levitz, that became publisher of DC Letter. He was the editor on Untold Legend of the Batman. I forgot to mention that. Trina Robbins did all the covers on that one, on that series. The Legend of Wonder Woman ran from May through August 1986, and like I said, ads trumpeted the series as the one last look at the original Wonder Woman. Trina Robbins was an influential underground comic artist, one of the most prominent female underground comics artists, known primarily for women's comics, women spelled W-I-M-M-I-N-S. She was a lifelong Wonder Woman fan, and a fan of the original artist and co-creator of Wonder Woman, H.G. Peter.
Mm-hmm.
Kurt Busiek was a fairly new comics writer at the time. He had written a JLA story that was a JLA, a
crossover.
JSA crossover, yeah, and the Red Tornado miniseries. And of course, he went on later to Marvel's famous run on the Avengers and tons of other great stuff. Astro City, his own creator-owned book. The object of this series was a fond look back at Wonder Woman's most popular period, the late Golden Age, that was favored by both Busiek and Robbins. And Robbins was actually buying the books off the stands as they came out at that time. In the letter column to issue number one, Busiek admits many people feel Wonder Woman is hard to get right in comics. It's like, you know, she's big in merchandise and other media, but it's hard to get her right in comics.
Well, and I completely get that. It's one of those things. I like the visual of Wonder Woman better than I do the story. You know, okay. I like the little bits and pieces. And I mean, this I remembered when I was buying comics and stuff like that. When I was a kid myself, I remembered buying, you know, the first issue or the second and third issue, and then I went back and got the first and fourth when I was older, because that's what I could find, because, you know, in the little town that Chris and I grew up in, it was hard to find. You know, we didn't have a comic shop. You
very
went to, like, Begley's drugstore and, you know, picked up your comics. But I remembered this comic more fondly than what it actually is, because I reread it again for us to do this episode, and I was just like, oh, I mean, I'll be honest. I was just like, wow.
Yeah.
You know?
Right, right. Well, and I think it's interesting. If you look at Wonder Woman's history, she has been rebooted, a pretty hard reboot, more than about any of the other characters. Even in the days before Crisis, in the 50s, they gave her kind of after Marston, her original creator, William Moulton Marston, had passed away in the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Conniger took over as writer. H.G. Peters stayed on as artist. But after he died at some point, they didn't really say everything's starting over, but they told her origin again. They changed some things. They had kind of done the same thing with Superman and Batman, but it did feel like there was a real kind of shift. Like Ross Andrew and Mike Esposito took over as artist. That's kind of where the Silver Age Wonder Woman began. And then even in that run, they did, for some reason, in 19, I think it was like 65 or 6, they went and started telling like Golden Age stories. They set stories in the 40s again. So it was like they couldn't figure out what to do with Wonder Woman. You know, it's
right,
like
right.
More so than the other characters. And I mean, I know Batman had his new look reboot or whatever. But then shortly after that, they did the whole she loses her powers and becomes Diana Prince Wonder Woman,
right.
The mod, you know, Diana Rigg type karate chopping Wonder Woman.
Right.
So, and then again in the 70s when the TV show took off after she got her powers back earlier in the 70s, in the mid 70s, the TV show set in the 40s, they set the comic book in the 40s. So the Wonder Woman really had.
My favorite version of Wonder Woman, I'm sorry, Linda Carter.
Right. But, you know, mine too. But. They had rebooted her probably more than any of the other characters, you know, with a little more of a hard reboot than just a changing of the guard type thing of new creators and things.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like. So it's funny because since this time, that has come up a lot. Wonder Woman's hard to figure out to do in the comics. You know, George Perez figured it out right after this. Had a really successful run, but it seemed like people had trouble after him.
Mm-hmm.
He had a good take on it.
She's one of those characters that you can do a story arc with, but it's hard to do a continuation. Does that make sense?
Right. It's like everybody wants to get in there and play in that toolbox or sandbox, whatever, but they don't. It's like they don't know. Yeah, you know, it's kind of like the long term.
Exactly.
You,
you know,
with her. Yeah.
You can do a story arc, but not a continuation.
Yeah. As far as this series goes, Wonder Woman's original series was canceled with issue 329 from February 1986, a Crisis crossover. In Crisis on Infinite Earths number 12, the Earth 1 Wonder Woman is blasted by the Anti-Monitor, and she seemingly dies in one panel. It's very, you know, anticlimactic. She's just dead. I mean, not like Flash and Supergirl the few issues before. She's just gone. The character of Harbinger... later relates that Wonder Woman did not die, but was instead sent back through time, devolving into the clay she was sculpted from, which spread itself across Paradise Island from which it had originally came. The Amazons left the island and returned to the Grecian isle they came from. So that was at the end of Crisis number 12. In the letter column of issue number 4, Trina Robbins related how the original plan was in Crisis was for Wonder Woman to be turned into a clay statue. And that's actually reflected in issue number 1 of this comic. That changed, you know, by the time that Crisis was printed, but apparently this had already been done, so they didn't go back and change it. So that just goes to show you that there were some things that, you know, people complain about stuff not matching up in the New 52 and things like that. Well, it's nothing new, apparently.
Well, things always happen. There's running changes.
Right, right. So I'm going to let you synopsize this series, so
okay.
Have fun, sucker.
Sucker, that's nice. In issue number 1 of the Wonder Woman series, It's Legends Live Forever, the Amazons of Paradise Island mourn beneath the clay statue, which was referenced just a moment ago, that was once Wonder Woman, while they prepare to leave their home. Queen Hippolyta, Wonder Woman's mother, finds the magic sphere among Diana's things. She uses it to gaze back into time and witness a parade in Washington, D.C., where Wonder Woman and Steve Trevor are part of the procession. Suddenly, Washington is attacked by Wonder Woman's old foe, Autonoma, and her neutronic slaves, who hail from a subatomic world grown large by atomic testing. Autonoma and her minions manage to kidnap several humans, including Steve Trevor, before disappearing back into their subatomic world. In the aftermath of the attack, Wonder Woman meets a young girl named Susie, who is the cousin of Wonder Woman's friend, Etta Candy. Susie's run away from home to share an adventure with Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman leaves Susie in the care of her alter ego, Diana Prince, who gives Susie a book on Greek myths and legends to occupy her time. I'm sorry, I gotta break in on this, but why didn't Wonder Woman, Diana Prince, whoever, call Susie's mother and say, come get this little brat?
Why didn't she jump in the invisible plane and take her home?
Exactly. But anyway, Susie witnesses Diana change into Wonder Woman and receive a visit from Paula of Paradise Island. Paula has brought Wonder Woman a nuclear triangulator to track Autonoma in her subatomic world. Locating her foe, the amazing Amazon confronts Autonoma near the Potomac, but Autonoma uses her radiation powers to mutate a nearby catfish into a Gillman-like creature to combat Diana. Wonder Woman has the creature on the ropes when Susie distracts her long enough to be knocked out by the monster. Before Autonoma can strike, Wonder Woman and Susie are saved by a mysterious benefactor who whisked them away in a strange ship. But Autonoma manages to blast the ship and send it crashing down. Somewhere in Asia, while in the present, a sorrowful Hippolyta watches on.
Very good.
Yeah.
How do you think you pronounce that? The main bad guy's name? Is it Autonoma? Atomia.
I know, I was struggling with that.
Atomia, Atomia, Mamma Mia.
Mamma Mia, here I go again. My, my, how can I resist you? Mamma Mia, does it show?
I don't know, I said it like 3 different times when I was reading through that.
I think it might be Atomia.
Well, Atomic.
Atomia.
Atomia.
Let's say Atomia.
Okay.
The cover features the catfish from the Blue Potomac. I mean, he looks like the creature, but he's red.
Yeah, he looks like the creature
with
from
whiskers,
Black Lagoon. Yeah.
With whiskers. Trina Robbins draws the characters in a style that's very similar to H.G. Peter.
But, like you pointed out when you were saying this, I wasn't familiar with his background work, but you said that was the main difference?
Yeah, it seemed like, you know, the backgrounds and stuff just weren't as detailed. I mean, he wasn't George Perez, but, I mean, this is no offense to Trina Robbins. I really like the really clean art style she's got in this, but there's, like, almost no backgrounds at all in this whole series. It's like, you know, I wish you could see. I'm no fan of drawing backgrounds myself when I do artwork, so I wish I could get away with that.
Right.
You know, but more power to her, man. Now, one thing you'll notice, Wonder Woman, you can see it right on the cover, she's got the WW symbol that she had just got earlier in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And she's got her shorter shorts. Those were concessions that Robbins made the WW to editorial, and then she said in one of the letter columns she felt like if she gave Wonder Woman the long, what do you call them, culottes? type shorts, almost like biker type shorts.
Biker shorts, yeah.
Biker shorts that, you know, they were long, they were tight, but they almost came down toward her knees that, you know, modern age fans might not, you know, take to them. So,
show a little skin.
Yeah, show a little skin. The letters column, the first issue, Kurt Busiek admits the story really cannot completely fit into any continuity. These characters are really more of from like the Earth 2 Wonder Woman or the Golden Age stories, but yet this is obviously the Earth 1 Wonder Woman because, you know, the crisis and everything.
It's almost like a what if.
Yeah, it's that's why it's called the legend. It's definitely Earth 1, but some of the aspects of the past story could be like almost a melding of Earth 1 and 2. Susie is a brat.
Oh my gosh. If our daughter acted like that, I would wear her tush out.
In the letter column issue number 2, Robin says Susie is essentially her at this age. I hope she wasn't quite this bad.
I mean, oh my gosh. I hope not. I mean, my goodness.
And it just gets worse, folks. By the end of this series, I have a daughter, and I don't want anything to happen to kids, but it's one of those cases where, you know, Susie was, you know, unfortunate victim of Atomia's rampage, right. You know, I'd been, oh, too bad. You know,
so. Gosh! A little bloodthirsty there.
Sorry. Atomia, or is that what I was going to say? She and her subatomic world had debuted Wonder Woman number 21 from January 1947.
So she had been an established character.
Right.
So.
Actually, all of the stuff in this one had been. Mm-hmm. So they did their research. So you want to synopsize issue number 2 for us?
Sure. Issue number 2 is the Land of Maris. Wonder Woman and Susie have survived the crash of their ship, but the pilot did not. Wonder Woman recognizes where they are, and she and Susie trek toward a series of mountains. Meanwhile, Steve and the other captives of Atomia are being forced to mine uranium to power the subatomic world. Steve discovers that the natives cannot touch the uranium as it destabilizes their atomic structure. Wonder Woman and Susie arrive in the Land of Mirrors, a place the Amazon has been before. There, she is reunited with the twin sisters and rulers, Solia and Leia. Leia had previously tried to overthrow her sister and have all of the land's power for herself. Thanks to Wonder Woman's intervention, and apparently they monkeyed with her brain chemistry, that's what I think is funny.
Yeah.
Thanks to Wonder Woman's intervention, she assures her that she is cured of her wicked ways. Susie becomes obsessed with the stories of Greek mythology, failing to grasp the moral lessons contained in each tale. Instead, becoming enraptured with the ideas of adventure, freedom, and power, because what she's doing is she reads the first of the adventure but doesn't read how they end.
Right.
You know, that's the problem there.
Right.
Always read through it.
Yeah.
Wonder Woman and Solia are attacked by Leia when she shows her true colors, allowing Atomia to access their land in return for her help in overthrowing her sister. Atomia betrays the betrayer, however, and destroys the Land of Mirrors. Atomia takes a defeated Wonder Woman and Solia as prisoners and takes Susie under her wing because she admires her self-centered spunk.
Have I mentioned Susie is a brat?
Oh my goodness.
So the Land of Mirrors had appeared before with Layla and Solela, or however you pronounce that, in Sensation Comics number 79, July 1948. So mm-hmm. That's another story they adapted from the Golden Age. I had a hard time figuring out which twin was which. I know that was kind of part of, you know, that was intentional to a point.
Right.
But it really wasn't because they were always together. It wasn't one of those kind of, aha, I'm not really the good one, I'm the evil one this time. They could have at least colored their outfits different or gave them slightly
like
different.
Like one of them blonde and one of them brunette even.
Well, if they were both blonde, fine, but, you know, one of them have a different hairstyle, you know? I mean, to have them, I couldn't tell who was who.
No.
And
no.
Maybe that's based on the Golden Age story because I think that's what the hook was in the Golden Age story. You know, Layla acted like she was the leader all the time and she had overthrown
her sister, Solela. Right.
So I'm guessing that's what happened. But, you got anything else to add on this one?
No. I mean, you move on to issue 3, okay. And that's Inside the Atom Galaxy, and a chained Wonder Woman, because remember, if she's chained, you know.
Yep.
loses her powers, kneels at the throne of Atomia and her new protege, Susie. Layla uses Wonder Woman's nuclear blah, blah, blah. That is hard to say. Triangulator.
Well, there's presidents that can't say it.
There you go. To sneak into the subatomic world and help Steve and the others free Wonder Woman. Steve, who is ill from radiation poisoning due to his sentence of uranium mining, has deduced some facts about the strange world they are trapped in. He takes Layla to the opposite side of the tiny world, and then she and Saleya's actions are linked, allowing Saleya to escape her imprisonment. Following another battle with Atomia, Wonder Woman takes Susie, Layla, and Saleya and leaves for Paradise Island. Personally, I would have left the little brat there to gather troops for an assault on Atama's world. In the present, Hippolyta asks Paula to rig up the time sphere so she can project its images for the whole island to see, to lift their spirits. The cover and splash are reminiscent of the hundreds of bondage images seen in Golden Age Wonder Woman comics.
Yes.
I mean, I have a problem with that. They like to tie Wonder Woman up. I mean, you know, that's one of those little count things. You
yeah,
know?
That. Well, that's, you know, Marston was a strange guy. You know, I don't know if we've touched on that.
Let's not.
But he was a strange guy into some strange stuff. And Wonder Woman sure did get tied up a lot. There was a lot of spanking, too. If there's a lot of weird stuff in those stories. Now, by the time Robin had become a fan of Wonder Woman, Marston had passed on and Conniger was the writer. He had excised a lot of the weirdness. But they still kept the stories in the similar vein. Mm-hmm. You still had H.G. Peter. So that's probably why there's only this one instance of the bondage chains. I did think it was interesting, though, you brought up Wonder Woman being chained, but that's actually part of the story. They chain her up thinking that she's, you know, subdued, but she's really not because a man didn't chain her
that's
up.
That's right, that's right.
Because if a man shackles her bracelets together, then she loses her power. But if a woman does it, she was just basically faking, trying to, you know, figure
playing
out.
Playing possum.
She was playing possum to figure out what was going on, yeah. Okay, Susie is now just plain evil. She's like sitting at the,
and dressed like Atomia, having her little green outfit.
She's like mini Atomia, you know, it's just like, which is just like, okay, you know, there's like no redemption for this character at this point. And there's no, you know, I mean, you can see it from a mile away, guys. They put a little girl in the story. At the end, she's going to help Wonder Woman, but there is no evolution of this character until like the last second. And
like the last two pages.
We'll get to that, but yeah, it's not coming. This is issue number 3. It's a 4-issue miniseries. You have yet to see a spark of anything beyond
redeeming quality.
Yeah, there's nothing there. In the text pieces, Busiek said he had worked with a scientist friend of his on the science in the story, but he still wanted to maintain some of the Golden Age comic wonkiness. He succeeded.
I'm trying to figure out what scientist he talked to. The scientist friend was snorting something. I'm sorry. You know.
The scientist friend lives in a box on the corner and he's got a tinfoil hat to keep the Martians from talking to him.
I think you're right. That's it.
Paula appears again. In the original Golden Age continuity, Paula was originally Baroness Paula von Gunther, a Nazi criminal Wonder Woman had reformed. She stayed in the series as an ally from then on, which is kind of, they used the same thing on her, I think they used on Layla to supposedly fix her.
Yeah.
You know, they rehabilitated her.
It's kind of like, you know, they used to shock people, you know, in the insane asylums. It's kind of the same thing.
That's like what they did, you know, in the Identity Crisis series where they lobotomized everybody. Justice League starts redoing everybody's brain. Thanks, Brad Meltzer. Thanks a lot. Okay, you want to do issue 4?
Okay. Issue number 4, Splitting the Atom. Susie trains with the Amazon warriors on Kangas, their secret weapon in the attack on Atomia's world. Susie cheats and is chastised for her behavior with the Amazons, trying to teach her that she is misinterpreting the lessons of the Greek legends and myths she's reading about. Wonder Woman rallies her troops, and as they arrive in the subatomic world, the battle is started. At the center of the world, Wonder Woman finds a strange gyroscopic machine and determines it must be what allows Atomia's world to grow and shrink. Susie, imagine this, finally, finally grows a conscience and helps Wonder Woman by throwing her book into the machine, destroying it. Wonder Woman, Susie, and the others escape just as the world poofs back to microscopic size permanently. Paula's purple ray heals the uranium poison Steve and the other humans. In the present, Queen Hippolyta is distraught as all the Amazons slowly lose any memory they have of Princess Diana, also known as Wonder Woman. Aphrodite appears, telling her that the mystic shields she has placed over Paradise Island are fading, and now the new reality created after the Great Crisis is starting to take hold. Soon, even the gods will forget that they knew of this reality, so that they will retain their memories before being replaced by the new versions of themselves. Aphrodite sends the Amazons to the heavens, which is what Hippolyta chooses, where they become constellations. She then removes the last of the mystic shields, and the new reality washes over Paradise Island, leaving Aphrodite to ponder, I wonder what it'll be like. Now, here's the thing. Hippolyta, I had a problem with this, and I told you this at the time.
Yeah.
Hippolyta is given the choice by Aphrodite. Do you want to remember and be a constellation, or do you want to be part of this new reality? And she's like, for all my people, I want it to be that way. And I mean, I get that she's queen, but she's making this decision to be made into stars for all of these women. I mean,
and they already don't know who Wonder Woman is, so I doubt they'd be like, what, who? What? We don't even know who you're talking about.
You know, what are we missing? But she's like, meh.
Now, I'll be honest, the post-crisis parts of this are really fascinating to me. Very few of the books dealt with it head on like this. The only other one I can think of is All-Star Squadron, which had a definite moment that the post-crisis world really started. Where, you know, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman of Earth 2 are all there in a picture. They take a picture. They're going to give it to FDR. The whole All-Star Squadron is together. By the time FDR gets it, they're not in the picture. They're rewritten out of history. And that's what's going on right here. It's at that moment where it's the continuity's really, you know, switching.
Kind of like, you know, you throw a rock into a pond and that see the what ripple the ripples. Effect. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it's kind of neat. Now, overall, this story really captured the Golden Age feel.
Right, the feel of it.
I mean, completely. And that might be, and I can read a Golden Age tale, and I enjoy them. But I think maybe because it was connected to the crisis, reading it now for this, I had a hard time kind of making it through it because I don't think my brain fully clicked on complete Golden Age tale as I was reading
right.
it until I got to the end. I'm like, oh, they really were going straight Golden Age here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it plays very much like a Golden Age story. You know, like, again, All-Star Squadron, set in the 40s, but and had a lot of the, obviously, retold some of the stories from the Golden Age, but written in a then-modern style. This was not written that way. It was a complete Golden Age-type story. And that was made it a little difficult to kind of get through. But, you know, we said that about Susie already. She slips. It's a light switch.
Oh, yeah.
When she decides to, should I help Wonder Woman? Why not? She throws the book at the, you know, the gyroscope thing that, you know, this little dinky thing that's making this the whole big problem. And, you know, it's destroyed by a book. So, throw that.
Hey, knowledge is power.
That's right.
As the librarian, I got to go with this.
You like that part of it.
Yeah. I do. In my day job, I'm a children's librarian at my local public library, and I'm all about that.
Yeah, well,
the
that's true.
The book destroyed it. So yeah. There you go.
The pen is mightier than the sword.
That's so, right.
Oddly enough, Superman had a bratty Susie to contend with in the Golden Age. It was Lois Lane's niece. And she was, you know, quite a pain.
Maybe it's something with the name.
Yeah, maybe it is. Maybe it had something to do with it. I don't know. It's she was quite a pain in the neck. So I think that's all we've got on this. You got anything else to add?
No, I mean, like I said, it's I still remember this fondly, and it's one of those things, reading it again.
Yeah.
I appreciate the artwork and everything else. It's the stories. I'm just kind of like, wow, okay. Yeah. I remembered it more fondly than what it It really is.
I think, and this is nothing. And I'm not. I don't want to be one of these people. I am definitely somebody who can appreciate. I can appreciate movies and comics and books that were of a different period.
Right.
And put myself in that period and say, like, I love the Universal movies, the Universal monster movies. I love them. And I can put myself in there and say, these were great. They're great in many ways now, but even some of the hokier ones, you know, I can appreciate them for what they are. That's what I think was the problem with this one. I didn't know going in that it, I had only basically flipped through it, your copies. I had never sat down and read it.
Right.
And I didn't know that it was this. I commend them for, they nailed it. They nailed that Golden Age feel.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But I wasn't prepared for the 100%
Golden Age
feel.
Take.
Yeah. But unfortunately, I don't think this has been collected either. So, you know, your best chance to read either of these is you either find the tour paperback for the Batman one, or you go, you know, find these in, you know, the back issue.
Well, actually, it was kind of funny. I could not find my set of the Wonder Woman comics because for whatever reason, who knows, Chris, of course, has all these ginormous long boxes of comics. It's kind of ridiculous everywhere. Anyway.
Everybody listening to this does.
Well, you know, this is the wife moment, so there you go.
Okay.
Anyway, I had actually, for some reason, taken the Wonder Woman comics, which was mine. This is like one of the few comics that's actually mine and not just Chris's that I read. But I had this set of comics, and I had put it on the bookshelf with my Wonder Woman books.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me forever to find it. And I went and looked on eBay, and you can actually pick up a set of these for like maybe $10, all four issues. So, yeah. I mean, it's easy to obtain.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're fun. I mean, they're fun to read, you know. And, I mean, I don't want people to think we enjoyed them.
Oh, yeah.
And you definitely, I noticed you had Cindy written in the... on the splash page of the issue 2 and 3.
Well, you have to figure. I mean, like I said about, you know, me writing my name on the back of my dolls and stuff.
Right.
I have a big brother and a big sister, and they tended to take my stuff, and so everything had its name on there. I mean, you can ask my mother, you can go to my mother's house right now, and you can still see where my brother, and we all did this apparently, he had put his name on the back of the chair that he sat at the kitchen table one day. And, I mean, you can still see it if you look real carefully. So, apparently this was a family thing that, you know, we didn't share well at my house.
Very possessive people. But, so, yeah, I thought that was sweet, though. And, so those kind of laid the foundation because your favorite comic book character is Wonder Woman.
Mm-hmm.
And my favorite comic book character is Batman.
Mm-hmm.
So these kind of helped lay the foundation for our obsessions. So there you go. And it was fun going through. Next time, we have a very special episode planned with a very special guest.
Ooh.
Oh, yes.
Tell us more.
I will. We will be discussing more Batman comics, but not because so much they're Batman comics, because they are written by a favorite writer of both myself and our esteemed guest, who will be none other than Rob Kelly.
Uh-huh.
Rob of the Fire and Water podcast, of the Aquaman Shrine, of the book Hey Kids Comics, and of the Ace Kilroy web strip. The writer, award-winning writer of the Ace Kilroy web strip.
Ooh, round of applause for him.
Right, well, yes. And of course, Rob is dragged me into this podcasting with my appearances on his Power Records episode, so it's all his fault. So we're going to have him come by, and we're going to talk stories by Alan Brennert, who is a famous TV writer, among other things, but he's only written a handful of comics, and they've almost all been Batman stories, but they have been some of the best Batman stories ever written, and two of them are in the greatest Batman stories ever told. So, you know, he's written a handful of comics, and he got two stories in the greatest Batman stories ever told. What's that tell you? So
pretty daggone good writer.
Pretty daggone good. So, yeah, so we'll be covering... I think the stories are from Detective Comics number 500, then Brave and the Bold number 182, and Brave and the Bold number 197, I believe, off the top of my head. So come back in 2 weeks and join us and our special guest, Rob, and we'll talk some great Batman stories. So, got any comments on this episode? We'd love to hear them. Write us at supermatespodcast@gmail.com. That's right, right?
Yeah.
I got it right. All right. So, send us a comment. Speaking of comments, we were going to maybe cover those in this episode. We went kind of long where we did both miniseries. We will cover those. Maybe that might be episode 9. We cover those after Rob's guest spot. So, we might cover, we're getting some really good feedback. I appreciate that. We've kind of got a new influx of feedback, some longer comments, and we really enjoyed them. And, of course, we've written people back, but we want to read them on the air. And we want to hear more. Write us, let us know. If you're a fan of Untold Legend of the Batman, Legend of Wonder Woman, not a fan, whatever, write us, and we'll read it. And until then, see ya. Bye. Supermates is a Franklin & Franklin production in association with Bugaloo Enterprises Worldwide. The fictional characters and events mentioned in this show are trademark and copyright their respective owners. Likewise, all audio clips are copyright their owners, and we mean no infringement by either. Thank you for listening to Supermates, the husband and wife geek cast.